before about, as I talked about before, since biblical times, since Old Testament times, and you know, for as far back as human beings have recorded history, there have been people who have philosophized about addiction. They have philosophized about alcoholism. They have philosophized about gluttony. They have philosophized about all this. Solomon, in the Old Testament, wrote about winos. They didn't have the hard liquor like they have now, but he wrote of drunkenness. Solomon philosophized that alcoholism, addiction, was an illness, but he had no cure for it, and he obviously couldn't prove his allegations or his theories. In England, at about the time of the 1640s, at around the time that William Shakespeare was alive, approximate time, there was a man who lived in England, and he was a doctor named Dr. Trotter. And Dr. Trotter philosophized that alcoholism was an illness, but he couldn't prove it, and he had no cure for it. One of the signers of the Declaration of Independence, a man by the name of Benjamin Rush, he was one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence. And if you ever come to my city, you'll see a street called Rush Street, and that street is named after him. Rush philosophized that alcoholism was an illness, but he couldn't prove it, and he had no cure for it. In the 1920s, in New York City, there was a neurologist named William D. Silkworth, and William Silkworth's friend was Charlie Towns, and Charlie Towns owned a hospital, and the hospital that he owned was the Towns Hospital, which at that time was the preeminent hospital for the treatment of drug addiction and alcoholism. In October of 1929, William Silkworth lost everything he had. And William Silkworth went to work for Charlie Towns in the Towns Hospital in late 1929 for $34 a week. Charlie Towns watched alcoholics come in and out of the hospital, and they would come in deplorable shape, deplorable conditions. And these guys would come in and they'd fix them up, and they'd send them back out after a while, and some of them they would never see again. And some of them would come back in a very short period of time, in worse shape than they had been in before, and some of them would come back to the hospital in horrible shape that very day that they were released. And he started to notice something about these, primarily they were men at that time, but he started noticing something about these drinkers that set them apart from the other drinkers, that there was something about a class of them that set them apart because they had the inability to leave it alone. They had the inability to leave it alone in the face of every desire not to touch it again. That no matter how hard they tried, their human will was of no avail. And he philosophized that alcoholism was an illness. And when the big book was being written in 37 and 38, it came out in April of 39, Bill asked Dr. Silkworth to write his opinion because he felt like they had to have a medical opinion of what was wrong. What is the nature of this? There are a lot of people that I've met in OA that really do not understand the nature of this illness. Why is it an illness? It's an illness because it's something that sets me apart from the norm. What is the nature of this? And William Silkworth said to Bill, I'll write this for you under one condition. Don't you put my name in that thing. He says, because the American Medical Association, the American Psychiatric Association, had not yet recognized alcoholism as an illness. His theories at that time were his theories, but they were not the consensus. And so he said, don't you put my name in that thing now. Now in 1955, and this was on page one of the big book, but in 1955, at the end of his life, the American Psychiatric Association, the American Medical Association, the second edition came out in 55. They had recognized alcoholism as an illness, and you can put my name in it now. But anyway, in the first edition, you don't have it. Anyway, let's find out what the doctor says together, and then I'm going to amplify some of that information and hopefully be helpful, hopefully. It says on page XXV, or 25 in Roman numerals, we of Alcoholics Anonymous believe that the reader will be interested in the medical estimate of the plan of recovery described in this book. Convincing testimony must surely come from medical men who have had experience with the sufferings of our members and have witnessed our return to health. A well-known doctor, chief physician at a nationally prominent hospital specializing in alcoholic and drug addiction, gave Alcoholics Anonymous this letter. Now, just to expound, this is Dr. Silkworth. He's the chief physician at a nationally prominent hospital. That's the town's hospital. Okay. To whom it may concern, I have specialized in the treatment of alcoholism for many years. In late 1934, I attended a patient who, though he had been a competent businessman of good earning capacity, was an alcoholic of a type I had come to regard as hopeless. One of the nicest things I can be today is hopeless. Because if I am without hope, then I'm ready to surrender. I'm done fighting, hopefully. In the course of his third treatment, he acquired certain ideas concerning a possible means of recovery. As part of his rehabilitation, he commenced to present his conceptions to other alcoholics, impressing upon them that they must do likewise with still others. This has become the basis of a rapidly growing fellowship of these men and their families. This man, here's a promise of the big book, you don't have to wait for page 83. This man and over 100 others appear to have recovered. Now I hear this in OA all the time. Can you recover? Yes, you can. The big book says you can. That doesn't mean I'm cured. It means I'm recovered. There is a difference between cured and recovered. I personally know scores of cases who were of the type with whom other methods had failed completely. I better be out of ideas because that's what this is. This is the last house on the block. I have to be out of ideas, and when it says here other methods had failed completely, everything I tried on my own, every diet, every pill, every doctor, every desire that I had to stop eating this way was of no avail. Excuse me. These facts appear to be of extreme medical importance because of the extraordinary possibilities of rapid growth inherent in this group. They may mark a new epoch in the annals of alcoholism. These men may have a remedy for thousands of such situations. You may rely absolutely on anything they say about themselves. Very truly yours, William D. Silkworth, M.D. Now this is very important information, and not to digress too much at this point, but one of the things I do want to let you know is that at a very prominent Ivy League university, there is a course taught every semester on alcoholism. And every semester, they prove his theory correct. They do brainwave scans and they measure the brainwaves of an alcoholic drinking, a gambler gambling, a sex addict looking at pornography, a compulsive overeater eating, and they are indiscernible in the laboratory. And these theories that Dr. Silkworth had at that time are proven to be correct. Let's find out what those theories are and let's expound on some of them so that we get a clearer picture. The physician who at our request gave us this letter has been kind enough to enlarge upon his views in another statement which follows. In this statement, he confirms what we who have suffered alcoholic torture must believe. Here's that word must again. You must believe this. What is it that I must believe? That the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. That up until this point, alcoholism, up until this point, gluttony, up until this point, addictive behavior, you were thought of as being weak or stupid or just absolutely imbecilic. You were thought to be less than because of who you were, and who you are today is fine. You are not bad or stupid or weak. You are sick. That the body, this is the very first time this enters into the picture. Up until then, it was thought that the remedies would lie within the mind or the spirit. It did not satisfy us to be told that we could not control our drinking just because we were maladjusted to life, that we were in full flight from reality or were outright mental defectives. These things were true to some extent, in fact, to a considerable extent with some of us, but we are sure that our bodies were sickened as well. Very important sentence here. In our belief, any picture of the alcoholic which leaves out this physical factor is incomplete. It's a two-fold illness there. Well, it's an illness of the spirit too, but it's physical, the allergy, and it's mental, the obsession. Doctor's theory that we have an allergy to alcohol interests us. As laymen, our opinion as to its soundness may, of course, mean little. But as ex-problem drinkers, we can say that his explanation makes good sense. It explains many things for which we cannot otherwise account. Though we work out our solution on the spiritual as well as an altruistic plane, we favor hospitalization for the alcoholic who is still very jittery or befogged. More often than not, it is imperative that a man's brain be cleared before he is approached, as he then has a better chance of understanding and accepting what we have to offer. Now, the doctor is going to write some things here, and I'm going to change one of the paragraphs around a little bit, if you will allow me to. Now, let's just keep going, and I'm going to change some things for you, and hopefully it'll help you as this helped me. The subject presented in this book seems to be of paramount importance to those afflicted with alcoholic addiction. I say this after many years' experience as medical director of one of the oldest hospitals in the country treating alcoholic and drug addiction. There was therefore a sense of real satisfaction when I was asked to contribute a few words on a subject which is covered in such masterly detail in these pages. Now, the next paragraph I'm going to read twice. And the first time I'm going to read it as it's written in the big book by William Silkworth, and then I'd like to change some of the words, if I may, and hopefully it will help you as it helped me. First run-through is as written. We doctors have realized for a long time that some form of moral psychology was of urgent importance to alcoholics, but its application presented difficulties beyond our conception. What with our ultra-modern standards, our scientific approach to everything, we are perhaps not well equipped to apply the powers of good that lie outside our synthetic knowledge. Now, I'm going to read that paragraph again, and if you will allow me to, I'm going to change some of the words, because I have to remember that Dr. Silkworth is a physician, and a physician is a man of science, and Dr. Silkworth was not a man of spiritual things. He was a man of science. He was a doctor. He had observations, but no solution. All he was observing was that these men that were going into the Oxford movement, which was a group of people practicing first century Christianity, and they were not concerned at all with alcoholism, that these men that he's talking about, the 100 men and the one man that he treated, which was Bill, they were recovering from their alcoholism. Let's change some of the words of this paragraph and see if it doesn't open a little up for you. We doctors have realized for a long time that some form of spiritual awakening was of urgent importance to alcoholics, but its applications presented difficulties beyond medicine's conception. What with our ultra-modern standards, doctors' scientific approach to everything, physicians are perhaps not well equipped to apply the powers of God that lie outside their medical knowledge. What is he telling me here? I understand what's wrong with you, and there's not a damn thing I can do for you. There's absolutely nothing I can do for you. I am a doctor. I cannot give you a spiritual awakening. I cannot give you a spiritual experience. You're going to have to do something else other than come to me. Look at how unfair we have come. We are still delivering truckloads of dreck to the medical profession and saying, cure us, help us, give us the cure, give us the surgery, give us this, give us that, cure me. And the doctors can't. They can't. They would love to, but they can't do it. And the reason that they can't is that only a spiritual awakening will alleviate my mental obsession. And that's very important information that I understand. Many years ago, one of the leading contributors to this book came under our care in this hospital, and while here, he acquired some ideas which he put into practical application at once. Later, he requested the privilege of being allowed to tell his story to other patients here, and with some misgiving, we consented. The cases we have followed through have been most interesting. In fact, many of them are amazing. The unselfishness of these men as we have come to know them, the entire absence of profit motive, and their community spirit is indeed inspiring to one who has labored long and wearily in this alcoholic field. They believe in themselves and still more in the power which pulls chronic alcoholics back from the gates of hell, of death. And that power is obviously God. Of course, an alcoholic ought to be free from his physical craving for liquor. This often requires a definite hospital procedure before psychological measures can be of maximum benefit. When he says psychological measures, I think spiritual awakening. He didn't know what to call it. He's calling it psychological measures. Spiritual awakening is what I think. We believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy. Excuse me. That the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. These allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all, and once having formed the habit and found they cannot break it, once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, their problems pile up on them and become astonishingly difficult to solve. I have a friend of mine back home that says, if you had my problems, you'd eat like me. And I said, if I ate like you, I'd have your problems. Frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices. Frothy emotional appeal. Please, Harlan, lose weight. Please, Harlan, go on a diet. Please, Harlan, do this. Go on a diet. Try this pill. Try this. Why don't you get up and do push-ups? Why don't you get up and do sit-ups? Why don't you do this? The frothy emotional appeal is something which I have been getting from the time I was a child. Excuse me, many of you have had the same exact experience, and all it sometimes did was make me want to eat more. I wanted to eat more because they were making me uncomfortable. I wanted to eat more because I was going to give them the proverbial one finger salute. I wanted to eat more because they were making me crazy. And the only thing that my mind knew to get to that was going to make me feel better was more food. Okay? The message which can interest and hold these alcoholic people must have depth and weight. Now, I'm going to digress here for just a second. And one of the things that I'm going to say is this. When he says that that message must have depth and weight, what I'm reminded of constantly is that in order for me to get this message, it must come from somebody who's been there. It must come from one of you. It cannot come from a psychiatrist, a psychologist. It can't come from a nutritionist. It can't come from a clergy person. All those people have great maximum value in our world. I am diminishing none of them. I'm not saying anything about them that is in any way, shape, or form negative. The world needs those people. The world has to have those people. But when it comes to this, it's no different today than it was when Bill met Bob. One compulsive overeater talking to another compulsive overeater. And that is why I'm going to say this again when we get to the 12th step, but I'm also going to say it now. We do not get recovery from absorbing spiritual information. We get recovery by transmitting spiritual information. You will not get recovery studying this in a room by yourself. This is not a college course. This is your life. This is you transmitting that spiritual information. And there is, as I'm going to tell you when we get to the 12th step again, you're going to hear this again, there is a price to pay for being in this room. And that price is going to be when that person who is trembling, many people have to be beat beyond recognition to walk into these rooms. They are scared to death. They have no clue what they're going to find in here. They only know what they have been told. That they're idiots. That they're weak. That they're stupid. That they're ugly. That they're unacceptable. That their life is a sham because they are fat. And in absolute desperation, in absolute desperation, they may come into these rooms and you may be the one person that can save their life, because you may be the one person that sends them out of their first meeting with something that the pay and ways couldn't give them, and the infomercials couldn't give them, and the doctors couldn't give them, and that's hope. Because you have survived hell. If you're thinking and you're sitting in the room and you're saying, well, I don't really have anything to give, I'm not abstinent, and I'm struggling, you can say to that person something that was told to us by Dr. Bob. In 1950 in Cleveland, Ohio, Dr. Bob was dying. His son walked him up to the stage. He gave his last AA talk and he said something profound. And in typical Dr. Bob fashion, it was simple. He said, let's not louse this thing up with Freudian psychologies and all these various other things that are of interest to other people. And let's not divert ourselves from the work here. He said, when all this is boiled down, it boils down to two things, love and service. And we all know what love is. And we all know what service is. And if you're sitting in this room today, or you're listening on tape, or you're wherever you are, you can sit next to that person who is dying of fear, who is suicidal, who has been written off by their doctor, who has been written off by their family, who has been written off by their bosses, and the world that they were born into as unacceptable. And you could sit down next to them, or they could sit down next to you, and you could extend your hand and say, hi, I'm whoever you are. And it's good to see you. I've been around these rooms for a while. Welcome to our meeting. And you may share something at that meeting, or you may hear something shared at that meeting that will light them up. Something that they can't get anywhere else, and that is identification. We do not come here for information. We come and stay for identification. Because you've been there. You can give them hope. They threw themselves together on a Tuesday night. It was freezing cold. They waited outside in the parking lot the first three or four times they came here. And they came into the meeting and they're a little late and they don't know the lingo and they don't know the jargon and they don't understand the hugging and the praying and all the other stuff. But you can give them something that will make them feel at home. Give them your hand. Give them your heart. Give them your number. Give them a minute to listen to them as to why they're there. Give them a minute so that they can hear why you're there. And they may go home and say to someone or to no one, I met a woman, she was wearing a blue dress, and she understood. She gets it. And she didn't tell me I was an idiot. And she didn't tell me to use more willpower. And she didn't give me a diet. And she didn't give me a bariatric surgical procedure to go and have. And some of them have had that too. And that's okay. They're welcome here too. That's fine. We're the last house on the block. We're the last house on the block. Because if they haven't got us to go to, there's nowhere. And that's one of the things, and I'm going to just move on with this, where we are falling down. We are spending money as we speak on a public relations firm that was hired in Rio Rancho to publicize us, and we should do that. That's fine. We should continue doing that. That's good work, and that's great. We spend hundreds of thousands of men and women hour attracting people to OA, and we should do that. That's very important. And we spend hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars to get people in the door. And there are people in the rooms sitting right next to you that are dying of their untreated addiction, and nobody lifts a finger. And we're watching them walk out. This is the other side of the coin, obviously. And we're watching them walk out, and they're dying. They're dying. Enough preaching for right now. Okay. In nearly all cases, sorry if I went overboard. In nearly all cases, their ideals must be grounded in a power greater than themselves if they are to recreate their lives. If any feel that a psychiatrist directing a hospital for alcoholics, we appear somewhat sentimental, let them stand with us a while on the firing line. See the tragedies, the despairing lives, the little children. Let the solving of these problems become a part of their daily work, and even of their sleeping moments, and the most cynical will not wonder that we have accepted and encouraged this movement. We feel after many years of experience that we have found nothing which has contributed more to the rehabilitation of these men than the altruistic movement now growing up among them. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. Many compulsive overeaters take issue with this. They say, no, I like the taste of food. I do too. This is September, and if you go to Chicago and you go out in the country, if there is any country left, but if you go out in the country, you can see these little farm stands, and they have sweet corn, and they have cabbage, and lettuce, and tomatoes, and onions, and all kinds of stuff. And we used to take a ride out there, like on a Saturday afternoon, like it is now, and we would get some of that stuff, and we would come home, and we would eat a salad with our stuff, and it was delicious. I also like the taste of Chicago pizza. You know, I've never spent money I didn't have or gone out in the middle of the night to get lettuce or tomatoes or cauliflower or onions. I've never done any of those things because the pizza was giving me an effect that the tomatoes and the onions and the cauliflower just didn't give me. It was giving me a sense of ease and comfort that came at once by eating it. And for about 25 seconds, the world was a good place again. For about 25 seconds, my 80-inch waist was a 32. For about 25 seconds, the girl I had a crush on was going to like me back. For about 25 seconds, everything in my life was as I would like it to be. It's like psychosis in a bottle or something, I don't know. But the truth of the matter is, what I did not understand is that the food was not doing that for my friends. I said for. You see, the world saw what the food was doing to me, making me fat, making me uncomfortable, cheating me out of where I could go and who I could be. It emasculated me. It deformed me. It put me through pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. But what the world couldn't see was what the food was doing for me. The food was giving me a sense of ease and comfort that came instantaneously when I eat it, and that is the effect that he is talking about. And it wasn't doing it for them. And because only if 9 out of 10 people do not feel what the food does in terms of that effect, and 1 out of 10 people feels the effect of the food the way he's describing here, then I am considered to be at illness or allergic, and that's what he's talking about. We hear this in meetings. It's an illness, it's a disease, it's an illness. There's people walking around the meetings, don't even know what that means. What it means is an abnormal reaction. The food wasn't giving them that effect. Why would they seek it? They got all the food they wanted every time they sat down to eat. And every time I sat down to eat, the more I ate, the more I want. The more I want, the more I ate, and it was just endless. I have compulsively overeaten for decades. I have eaten more food than some countries. I have eaten so much food that it came very close to killing me, but I have never gotten all the food that I wanted. Because getting all the food that I wanted, by definition of my illness, is beyond me. Because the more I eat, the more I want. The more I want, the more I eat, and it's endless, it's infinite. It's like trying to find the bottom of an endless cave. It can't be done. It can't be done. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it, it's injurious, they cannot after a time differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. It seemed to me that eating the way I ate and thinking about food the way I thought about food, I had a sense that this is not okay, but I didn't ever see another way. I didn't know that there would ever be another way. When I'm not eating, here's what happens to me. When I'm not eating, I am restless, irritable, and discontented unless I can again experience the sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks. Drinks which they see others taking with impunity, and what impunity means is just indifference. After they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops, they pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful, with a firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over again, and unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there is very little hope of his recovery. When I see psychic change in my mind and in my book, I change it to spiritual awakening. Remember that Dr. Silkworth was not a man of spirit, he was a doctor. And so when he writes psychic change, he means a spiritual awakening. On the other hand, strange as this may seem to those who do not understand, once a psychic change, spiritual awakening, has occurred, the very same person who seemed doomed, who had so many problems he despaired of ever solving them, suddenly finds himself easily able to control his desire for alcohol, the only effort necessary being that required to follow a few simple rules. The rules are the steps. The rules are the musts of the program, the book. Men have cried out to me in sincere and despairing appeal, "Doctor, I cannot go on like this. I have everything to live for. I must stop, but I cannot. You must help me." Faced with this problem, if a doctor is honest with himself, he must sometimes feel his own inadequacy. Although he gives all that is in him, it is often not enough. one feels that something more than human power is needed to produce the essential spiritual awakening, psychic change, spiritual awakening. Though the area of recoveries is resulting from psychiatric effort is considerable, we physicians must admit we have made very little little impression upon the problem as a whole. Many types do not respond to the ordinary psychological approach. The ordinary psychological approach that he's talking about is the appeals and treating you like a doctor would, with drugs, with pills, whatever that might be. It wasn't working. As I described in my story, and as you could get up here and describe in yours, when those pills wore off, I ate Illinois and most of Wisconsin. When those pills wore off, the disease didn't go away. It's sort of like, I happen to have hay fever. And I have been afflicted with hay fever my whole life. And I have pills that I can take, because hay fever is an allergy. I have pills that I can take that will treat the symptoms of hay fever. I do not have a pill I can take to rid me of the hay fever. And when I don't take my pills for the hay fever symptoms, guess what? I start sneezing, my eyes run, they're watery, they're itchy, because when the pill wears off, the symptom is back. That's the same thing. I do not hold with those who believe that alcoholism is entirely a problem of mental control. I've had many men who, for example, worked out a period of months of the same, on some problem or business deal which was to be settled on a certain date, favorably to them. They took a drink a day or so prior to the date, and then the phenomenon of craving at once became paramount to all other interests, so that the important appointment was not met. These men were not drinking to escape, they were drinking to overcome a craving beyond their mental control. There are many such situations which arise out of the phenomenon of craving which cause men to make the supreme sacrifice rather than continue to fight. Let's go down to the line at all these and many others paragraph. It says here, the last sentence of that paragraph, it says, the only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence. And this is where a lot of you, or maybe some, or hopefully a few or none, are going to get up on me when I get down from here. I believe that you must be abstinent from compulsive overeating to work the steps. There is no record that I see of people drinking and drugging and working the steps and having a spiritual awakening. I just don't see that. Unless I am on a food plan, unless I am working my food plan, unless I am working the steps, I am not going to have it. And I'm either abstinent or I'm not. Now, this is something that I use as a definition. If you don't like this definition, don't use it. I'm just going to give you mine, since you're going to end up asking me this anyway. I define abstinence as being at or approaching a normal body weight. If I am not at or approaching a normal body weight, I am not abstinent. That means that if I'm 490 pounds when I come in, and I am now 486 pounds, am I abstinent? Yes, because I am approaching a normal body weight. And I really like that definition because it works as well for the anorexics and bulimics as it does for the compulsive overeater. Because the same thing can apply if you're at or approaching a normal body weight. And that's the one thing I will say about the abstinence that usually will get more of a reaction from you guys than anything else I'm going to say here. Okay. I'm prepared. I have this bottle. I will throw it. Okay. This immediately precipitates us into a seething cauldron of debate. Much has been written pro and con, but among physicians, the general opinion seems to be that most chronic alcoholics are doomed. What is the solution? Perhaps I can best answer this by relating one of my experiences. About a 1 year prior to this experience, a man was brought in to be treated for chronic alcoholism. He had been partially recovered from a gastric hemorrhage and seemed to be a case of pathological mental deterioration. He had lost everything worthwhile in life and was only living, one might say, to drink. He frankly admitted and believed that for him there was no hope. Following the elimination of alcohol, there was found to be no permanent brain injury. He accepted the plan outlined in this book. 1 year later, he called to see me, and I experienced a very strange sensation. I knew the man by name and partly recognized his features, but their all resemblance ended. From a trembling, despairing, nervous wreck had emerged a man brimming over with self-reliance and contentment. I talked with him for some time, but was not able to bring myself to feel that I had known him before. To me, he was a stranger, and so he left me. A long time has passed with no return to alcohol. When I need a mental uplift, I often think of another case brought in by a physician prominent in New York. The patient had made his own diagnosis and, deciding his situation hopeless, had hidden in a deserted barn, determined to die. He was rescued by a searching party and in desperate condition brought to me. Following his physical rehabilitation, he had had a talk with me in which he frankly stated he thought the treatment a waste of effort, unless I could assure him, which no one ever had, that in the future he would have the willpower to resist the impulse to drink. His alcoholic problem was so complex and his depression so great that we felt his only hope would be through what we then called moral psychology. And again, hate to beleaguer it, but if you just put in spiritual awakening, it'll just make a heck of a lot more sense. And we doubted even that would have any effect. However, he did become sold on the ideas contained in this book. He has not had a drink for a great many years. I see him now and then, and he is as fine a specimen of manhood as one could wish to meet. I earnestly advise every alcoholic to read this book through, and though perhaps he came to scoff, he may remain to pray. This is the crux of it. Let's take a very quick, not like last time, break, because we're a little pushed. I want to finish Bill's story by 4:30.